Many thanks for being invited to speak today. I'm afraid I do not speak German, Italian, French, Belgian, Swiss, Estonian, Latvian. I speak English or American or Australian. So I will speak very slowly. If you have any questions, please raise your hand if you do not understand me. If you think I am going too quickly, also raise your hands and go. And I'd like to go slower. Okay? I want to talk about our welcome in Europe, the welcome that trans people have in our new Europe of today. So in order to do that, I need to explain some things about the European Union and how it works, and also about the European Convention on Human Rights and how that works. Because I think many people get quite confused as to how the mechanisms of both organisations work and how we can use them. The European Union, which is a federal financial union of Europe, is actually now 25 countries altogether. I was quite surprised when I went to count them again, because they seem to always get more and more and more. In the last couple of years, we have seen some significant changes, and we have seen the introduction of countries which we have not thought of before as being European. Countries like the Czech Republic, Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Slovakia, Slovenia. These are all states which are a part of our federal union now. So when we do work in Europe, we are also working for those states and the people in those states. In the next year, there will be two more countries joining the Union. The countries are Bulgaria and Croatia. And we have two more countries which are currently applying to be European, part of the Union, and those are Romania and Turkey. So in 3 years' time, we can expect to see a union which is nearly 30 countries strong. That union has a commonality of certain aspects of law. And effectively, if we can change the law relating to one of those countries and its relationship with Europe, we can change the law in relation to the whole of those countries in Europe. Perhaps the most relevant part of the Union is that those countries which are members, they promise to abide by the law of the Union. In other words, they agree to whatever is in Union law. They agree also to respond, to take on board the decisions of the European Court of Justice. Now, in Europe, there are many fundamental principles that form the basis of the Union, but perhaps two of the most important ones for us is, first of all, that there is, in effect, free movement for workers within the Union. And attached to that free movement of workers is a right of family reunification, putting families back together after somebody from outside Europe has had a right to stay in Europe for 3 years, for 1 year. So if somebody from the Philippines can come and work in Europe for 1 year, they then have a right to effectively bring in their family and their direct dependents. There is also asserting of rights related to some financial aspects of our lives, particularly those related to work and in relation to services. So when there is a right relating to work and pay, it should be available to all European citizens or people who are resident in Europe, which is also very important to us, because it means that anti-discrimination law does acknowledge that we have some rights to anti-discrimination practices in Europe. So these equal access, this principle of equal access to core rights within the Union, both practical and economic, is fundamentally a right that we have a resource to access. The Union primarily focuses, however, the European Union, those 29 countries and this body of federal law, relates primarily to financial rights, not human rights per se, but financial rights. But if we think about financial rights, the right to work, the right to get paid equally, the right to get access to pension, in fact, these are core rights that enable you to access human rights. You cannot access your human rights unless you have the money to actually live your life in a reasonably successful way and to be empowered to argue for your other rights. So the European Union is a very, very important part of the services, the framework that we can access. Within Europe, we also talk about the European Convention of Human Rights. Is that my phone? No? The European Convention of Human Rights is a treaty, right? And it is much bigger. The countries who are involved in the convention are much bigger than those involved in the Union. In fact, there are 45 countries now signed up to the convention. That includes most of the East European former communist countries, countries like Poland, like Latvia, like Lithuania, and also several countries that were part of the former Soviet Union itself. So those countries which were communist, but now also countries in the Soviet Union. Right? And they sign up to a treaty which says that they will respect the convention rights for their citizens. Right? So they pledge towards maintaining the human rights of their citizens according to the convention. Those countries also agree to acknowledge and respond to European Court of Human Rights decisions. Now, technically, when you go to the European Court of Human Rights, the decision only affects the country which you have made an application against. So if you make an application against Belgium, the decision only affects Belgium. But, right, the European Court of Human Rights is an interesting court because it has both types of legal structure that exists within Europe put together. In England, we have a common law system, and that is when a decision is made at a high level, it becomes what we call a precedent. In other words, it is a decision that must be followed in similar cases. In French law, for example, it's the Roman law system, and the whole system is designed to explore what the actual circumstances and truths are behind the case. But the European Court of Human Rights has both aspects of that. They have three parties to a case. They have the Commission, they have the applicant, they have the people who are in opposition to the applicant. And consequently, these two elements work together very, very well. Because it is a case of exploring the truth, but also making a decision that will last for years. Therefore, even if a building based in state does not follow a decision, such as done with the line, they refuse it, they ignore it. The fact is an applicant in the same circumstances can bring a case and they are pretty well certain what the answer will be. And my experience of this throughout Europe has been, if there is a big case worrying Europe, an applicant should make an application, and then all we need to do is explain to the relevant government that this case is going to win, absolutely certainly, and they will then start to respond before you even get to court. So the European Convention is an incredibly useful tool. Now there are articles in the Convention about our human rights. There are three which we have used most, and perhaps are the most useful. There's Article 8, the right to respect for private and family life. Now, it isn't just family life, it's also privacy. And that privacy relates beyond just family life. So in principle, the decision in Goodwin and I gave a right of privacy, which includes the right of privacy to your former medical history. So you don't have to always say, by the way, I'm transgender or transsexual. You have a right of privacy over that. Obviously, Article 12 is the right to marry and found a family. Goodwin and I held an absolute right to marry. And the court said that this idea that was throughout many parts of Europe, that transsexual people had a right to marry because they could marry somebody of the opposite biological sex, but of the same gender, was fundamentally contravening the inherent frameworks and aspects of marriage. So they said, you know, you must be able to marry somebody of the opposite gender, not of the opposite sex. Finally, Article 14, which is the prohibition of discrimination in using these articles. Now, Article 14 does not include gender, it does not include transsexuals, it does not include gender identity or gender presentation. It lists a lot of other things, race, sex, disability, religion, sexual orientation. I don't think sexual orientation is in yet, but it gives a long list. But that list is not a closed list. That list can be opened and things can be added to that list at all times. So the court can make a decision effectively to add something to that list. We haven't used Article 14 very much, but it was raised in the cases of Goodwin and I, and the court, though they didn't add the things to the list, very much responded to the ideas of the article. But also, I think, another couple of very important articles that we have not used yet. The first one is Article 10. This is the freedom of expression, the right to freedom of expression. We haven't used it as a community yet. But if you think about it, if you have a right to freedom of expression, then you have a right to present your ideas in a way, so long as it doesn't contravene national security or cause a crime or anything else. So when we start to think about transgender rights, or when you try to think about rights relating to different gender presentations, perhaps this would be the ideal one that they start to use in order to extend the rights to the rest of our community. There's also another article I want to mention, and that is Article 9. This is the freedom of thought, conscience and religion article. This is the real problem we are facing, because all the churches will use it to try and stop us doing the things that we want to do. They will say that they have a right of freedom, conscience and religion, but we don't. They will say, we are so weird, we are so peculiar, that their rights overstep our rights. Now in fact, this has been listened to in many countries, in Italy, in Britain, it's an argument made in France, it's even an argument made in a country like Holland. Now, the reason why that article has such force is because the cases in Europe hint, and it is just a hint, at the idea that Article 9 rights have a supremacy over other rights. There are some rights that you cannot break, for example, freedom from torture. You cannot break that right. But Article 9 rights, they are saying, is the same as that. It has an overriding place over the rest of the rights. And this is being used quite strongly by church and religious organisations. In fact, I would argue this right, this law, has no supremacy over the other rights. But case law is close to saying that it does. So consequently, we are going to see religious bodies trying to stop us doing this, meeting in this room, trying to campaign for our rights. And I think we must watch for that one very, very carefully. Overall...
Can you repeat?
Yes, I can repeat. Article 9 is the freedom of thought, conscience and religion. There has been some case law at the European Court of Human Rights which has questioned, promoted the idea that Article 9 rights are supreme. So consequently, if I am arguing family rights against religion rights, the religion rights are more important than the family rights. So, we are seeing churches and other religious bodies using these Article 9 rights to argue against any change we want to make. So if I go to Spain and I argue that we want new rights for transsexual people, the churches will go, we have supreme rights and we don't want them. So that is the problem, a big problem we are beginning to see. But overall, we live in a modern European Union with a Court of Justice, a Convention on Human Rights. You would think that trans people could now be safe, could be firm in their everyday lives, and not regularly face the sort of arbitrary discrimination, the aggression, the regular attacks that we see are not just our bodies, but on our privacy, on our places we work, on the businesses we run, the homes we have with our families. But it's not like that. Those things still are taking place. I want to start with a quick start, go on, to a quick run-through about what we know about the overall legal position in Europe. And because I know Joanne is speaking later, I'm going to talk about the areas of uncertainty, not certainty. I'm going to tell you those places where we are inadequate. Fundamentally, if we start from the core position, the European Convention Human Rights allowed the European Court of Human Rights to give us some basic rights. That was a right of privacy, a right to marry, and a right to found a family. Those are three rights we know we have. When we look at this in reality, first of all states have a mechanism for recognising a change of legal status, except for Andorra, Albania, which is working on it, and the Republic of Ireland. Okay? In some cases, it is an administrative form. In other countries, it is a judicial process. So some countries you go to court, other countries you ask an administrator to make changes. But there is no certainty. And because there is no certainty on those mechanisms, lots of people do not access them because they don't know where to go. And lots of people in governments, in administration, they don't know anything about it. But we have tried to do surveys throughout Europe with the official bodies, invariably the answer is, we don't know anything about it, can we pass it on to somebody else? And this goes on and on and on. So we often can't get a clear answer. Regarding legal recognition, to date, only the United Kingdom actually allowed a change of legal status without any gender reassignment surgery. Every other country has some form of surgery. So we only have one, and the state is working towards legislation which will also allow no gender reassignment surgery. This is really difficult area because we know there are people who cannot have gender reassignment surgery because it would kill them. We also know there are people who just don't want it, but they are living very happily as women or men. We also know people who feel that their bodies are theirs to do with what they want. You know, but they want to get back from their day-to-day life in safety. And this is, it is a core issue, something we must address. Even in the UK, where we have a system whereby you can get legal recognition without gender reassignment surgery, we were reading a report yesterday in which it was suggested at the level of the courts that they must be careful because some people would go to gender reassignment surgery in order to be sex workers. There's nothing on the application that asks for your job. So how do they think they're going to discover whether they are sex workers? Furthermore, you and I know many people do sex work in order to get the money to get surgery. Other people stay on in sex work because it's the only job they know and they're not going to get another job. But what's wrong with being a sex worker? Why not? So this idea, this whole controlling mechanism is still there. Most countries will not recognise the legal change of gender from another country. Most countries, if you have a change in Sweden, we won't recognise it in Britain or Spain. Only the United Kingdom at this point has a formal means, an absolutely structured mechanism which you can use, which will allow there to be a recognition of a legal change of status from another country. So if you're coming to Britain, you can fill in the forms, you can produce your own birth certificate, you can produce your paperwork, and then we will recognise your change status. But no other country will do that.
That's not true. That's not true. I have my legal gender change in Germany and the Netherlands recognize no problem.
I was going to say, they will recognize it, but it is an informal mechanism. It's not a formal mechanism. So different countries, different beats. I can go to Holland and get recognition. It's not a formal mechanism. I mean, there's no guaranteed right for it. It is a Council of Europe directive, but it has never been implemented. So, well, I'm happy to look at that now. I mean, if we could get this information together, please. Some countries, as you know, still insist on divorce before a legal recognition of change of gender. I wish I could find a country which did not insist on divorce before a change of legal gender.
Belgium.
But in fact, if you think about it, this question of divorce, only trans people are actually forced into a position of having to have a divorce in order to get either health treatment that they absolutely need, or in order to get one of their core human rights that the European Court of Human Rights has given them. Nobody else is asked to get divorced in order to do that. We have not found one precedent anywhere which says you must get divorced in order to get your legal rights or in order to get your health care. It's dreadful, isn't it? This is how little we are valued. And how little our families are valued in that we are forced into divorce. Gender reassignment surgery is technically available throughout Europe, but there is little, if any, measure of control over the rules that are used to, and I would say the rules that are used to stop us accessing gender reassignment, the things that are used to stop us getting the treatment. For example, medical teams in some countries, but not all, still require a person to be born, as I've mentioned, before they're allowed to have gender reassignment surgery. Some countries, particularly, for example, Denmark, Sweden, Holland, until very recently, insist on a state-controlled routeway before a person will get gender reassignment or legal recognition. In other words, you go through this clinic, you see this doctor, you do it our way, or you will not get anything. Now, for some people, it means they're travelling miles to get their basic health treatment, and often I think it is using us as guinea pigs. They make some of us wait ages, with some of us they give it very quickly, and they are writing our case studies for their research papers. Those countries which have some form of welfare health system, which is most European countries, have some sort of social welfare health system at some level, which poorer people have to use and access, simply you don't have any budget for doing this, any money. So you have to go through a social welfare system. And you discover, they assess you, they say, yes, you need surgery, and then they say, but we have no money, you are on the waiting list. How long is the waiting list? 12 years. That is so common. Most countries won't recognise the new gender of a trans person born outside the European Union. Holland and the UK are the clear exceptions. So it's people born in third countries. You've had a change of gender recognition there, not accepted here at all. Right? So for example, if you're a trans woman who wants to go and live with your partner, male partner, in Italy or in Czech Republic, or any of those other countries, you have to use the same-sex partners rules. You have to totally humiliate yourself and say that actually I'm a man in order to move to live with your partner. Right. Most countries actually allow marriage, but actually some of them have really excessive requirements. Italy, for example. Right. Some countries, most countries, hypothetically allow adoption. In some countries they insist you are married in order to adopt, not at all. But in fact, when I have tried to find successful reports of adoptions, and I have emailed everybody around, I get very, very few reports of successful adoptions, except in Holland. Hardly anybody knows anybody who's managed to successfully adopt the child. So, you know, even though it's a right we have, it's not a right we can actually get. Few countries, if we look at the European Union level, so that was the convention, if we look at the European Union, I don't know any country which will be formally recognised or develop a policy where transgender status is a reason for claiming asylum. So no matter what goes on in the home country, no matter how often you're jailed or raped or imprisoned, if it's because you're trans, that is not a reason to be given asylum status at all. We can win cases on an individual basis. And we do win cases on an individual basis, but there is no formal policy as such that we can find that actually specifically includes transgender and transsexual people and being transgender as being a reason for asylum. Now, at the European Court of Justice, union level, in fact, we have full employment rights, which appears to have full employment protection after the decision in P&S and Cornwall County Council. That covers those intending to undergoing or having undergone gender reassignment. However, most of us in the west of Europe know we have that right, but most people in the east of Europe have no idea yet that they have that right. They seem to be completely ignorant of that protection, and most new Eastern European states at this stage seem to ignore it completely. They just never happened, I guess. No country actually protects a person in employment, according to what I can find, just simply because of their transgender status or their gender presentation status. We get some mentions of gender identity, but nothing that gets down as far as gender presentation. We're protecting general rights in employment because nobody is not transsexual. Very few countries provide anti-discrimination protection in the area of goods and services, and if they do, it is contained within the framework of the new gender, if you can imagine. So you get protected as a man or a woman because you become a man or because you become a woman. Think about that for a minute. If you're protected as a man or a woman, or because you're intending to undergo or having undergone gender reassignment, what happens when you do all that, when you become a man or a woman, but they're not discriminating against you because you're a woman? They're not discriminating against you because you're a man, but they're discriminating against you because you're trans. That's a difficult concept. But the clear, you know, they will say, well, this person's finished their gender reassignment. I don't discriminate against them as a woman. All women in my shop get treated equally with men. But actually, this person is a trans person. And it's not because they've had surgery, I just do not like the fact that they are trans. And therefore, there's no possible mechanism whereby these people can be protected. It's called, actually, the misery of equality. The misery of equality. We treat trans men and trans women equally badly, We treat everybody else badly. We'll treat you equally badly, and that's fine because we do both of you. So there's no discrimination. Now, what that lack of consistency does throughout European states means that many trans people are actually excluded from the full benefits of European citizenship. We only access part of the benefits of European citizenship. We have seen the courts, the European Court of Justice, the European Convention on Human Rights, who are actually taking a more liberal perspective, a more liberal view about trans people's lives. But there are significant gaps in the issues they have addressed. And in fact, apart from the UK, there have been significant lack of numbers of applicants to the courts. I don't know what it is about us in Britain. I think we're just bored, really angry. But go to court. But I think there are cases to be coming from other countries as well. Get in there, you know, it's quite fun in some senses. One of the problems is, actually, in relation to this, is I think it's partly down to us, the campaigners. We've done something right, but we've also done something wrong. And what we have done, is we've restricted our cases, the cases we pursued applications with, to those that we very much thought we would have had a chance of winning. That is only sensible. We pursued those cases which we thought we would have a chance of winning, and consequently we have not pursued the cases at the edges. The cases of transgender people, the cases of cross-dressers, the cases of non-surgical people. I have written out the email saying, I need somebody who has been refused hormone treatment, but who has, you know, had gender reassignment surgery in the past, I have. And I write this down, a list of what I want of somebody to take the case. But we need to be more exploratory, I think. There are good reasons why we've done this. First of all, actually taking cases demands a lot of effort, a lot of time, and often money. And we don't have money, do we? Who has money? And they're also very, very intrusive on the line of the applicant. Even if we manage to get reporting restrictions on cases and case names, the fact is these applicants will live through years of papers coming and other things to be completed, and going to see lawyers and having to give details again. So it is very intrusive on their lives. We have to warn applicants also that we will often not start with the big case, but we will have to start at the lowest court in our own country. And we have to climb up the courts. And on many occasions, they will lose their case. We have to lose and lose and lose and lose before we get to the point where we can win. And this is really disheartening. For the applicants, I have lost cases like this. And you know you're going to lose them. But you still feel so disappointed and so upset. And you are also involving so many people, whether it's your mother or your partner or your children. They also are very distressed by losing a case. So, you know, people in the community who do these cases are going to face a very difficult time. And actually, we have to tell them that they're not going to get an answer probably for 3 to 5 years. That's how much of their life they're going to give away to do this. We also have to know that the two courts are very different. And our approaches as campaigners must be designed to best persuade the individual court to make what is a very forward-looking and daring decision. Something going out there, right? Now, you know, how many judges want to do forward and daring opinions? Most of them are rather conservative. Yeah. If you look at the transsexual cases in the European Court of Human Rights, how many went before we got to the Goodwin denying decisions? There's an awful lot of cases, over 30 years of case law, before we got the court to make that daring decision. One of the other problems in the European Court of Human Rights is you're going to have to be prepared to lose, no matter how well argued your case is. If I tell you that, having got there, you've done your arguments, the other side's done its arguments, the Commission's made its arguments, you go to hear the decision, and you make the decision on something completely different. Not of the arguments were made. They decide on the basis of the margin of appreciation. But not all countries do this yet. So we'll give you a margin of appreciation. I can tell you, from personal experience, that is the most disappointing thing you can hear. Because they have not talked about your arguments at all. It's as if you never said anything. And they just made this decision on the margin of appreciation. And you feel like you can never win under those circumstances. In the European Court of Justice, we have to remember that there's a very limited range of cases that we can take. Those based on financial loss within the workplace, or family loss in freedom of movement settings. So you're quite restricted. We have to, in the European Court of Justice, you have to remember that what the court does is actually, it doesn't make new law, not at all. It makes no new law. But it reinterprets the law which already exists. So it takes something that already exists and says, I think that should be read as. Yeah, it will read it like that. It should have always been like that. So consequently, when you go to court, you have to be prepared to lose because the court actually doesn't feel very safe reinterpreting the law that's already there. Particularly things like the Equal Treatment Directives. Now all of this is incredibly hard work, and I actually do think that the only way you can do it is to have really committed people who are prepared to learn to be professional in what they do, to get the knowledge that is required to campaign, to give up their time. And my honest view is the only successful campaigner is somebody who has been doing it for at least 10 years. So when you start, you make a long-term commitment. Because it takes 10 years to get the amount of knowledge you need to use your work for our benefits. But it's very great fun, it makes really a so do it. Secondly, we need to be aware that we're not going to get money to do it. This is not a rich community. Everybody struggles financially. Everybody has very limited money. So you're going to do it on a shoestring. You're going to be handing over money yourself, invariably. But if you start to be good, as we have learned in Quest for Change, when you need money, when you ask for money, if you're good at what you do, people will give you money. Don't ask for it all the time, but ask it when you need it, and they will give you it. What we also need to know is that when we get these decisions, if we get one decision, we're going to have to be the people who spread it throughout Europe. For example, PNS, the employment case of the European Court of Justice, it is totally ignored in many of the Eastern European states. Those people in the Eastern European states are terrified of being public. So we're going to have to find some way of telling them in order for them to use it. The fact is, in order to do this, you've got to be prepared to work hard, to be really committed to learning, and be prepared to, in English we say, put your head above the parapet. Show your head, be shot at. Put yourself there, be prepared to be shot. Now, The fact is that many people do get shot in this process. Every day of my life, I hear stories of some terrified trans person who had a horrific life history as a victim of abuse in their homes, their workplaces, in the streets, and from official bodies such as the police or welfare organisations. The advantages of being a European citizen are completely lost to many trans people in Europe. How can we say this is an effective federal state of Europe unless we can make it truly federal for everybody in it? How are we going to make things different? And we have a right to a high level of privacy about our medical history. We have a right to marry or form a same-sex partnership if your country has it. We have a right to the best medical treatment in Europe, no matter where it is in Europe. How many of you knew that? You have a right for the European Court of Justice case law to get your treatment in any other country in Europe. You might have to pay a bit towards it, but you will not have to pay for all of it. The most you will pay for is actually the nights you have in hospital. You do not have to pay for your surgery. How many of you know that? We have a right to found a family. We have a right to workplace protection. Now, what I want to finish on is a bit that's missing. Goods and services. Now, in December 2004, the European Council adopted a directive. This directive implemented the principle of equal treatment between women and men. This is Stone Age, ancient language. In the process, equal treatment to women and men in the access to the supply of goods and services. Member states have to bring into force laws, regulations, and other provisions to comply with this directive by the 21st of December 2007 at the latest. And we look at this directive. There are exemptions, but those exemptions can only be used for legitimate aims, such as protection of victims in a sex-related violence shelter. But member states are also obliged to create a body or bodies for promotion, analysis, monitoring, and support of equal treatment for all persons without discrimination on the grounds of sex. So they have to create a body, right, which is going to oversee, making sure this happens, supporting people who have cases. Right? These bodies are to be formed as part of agencies charged at a national level with the defence of human rights. This is the first time we have human rights and the European Court of Justice were put together. Some countries have a little bit of that anyway. Sweden, for example, the sexuality of those men, he has those things anyway. But we now are going to have through Europe this particular national organisation which promotes these rights but places them in the context of human rights. Okay? Now, it all says sex equality, men and women. But we pushed and we pushed and we pushed the UK government and said we wanted to get this extended to trans people in non-employment areas. Unfortunately, the report back was that there was hardly any support from any other European state for this to include transsexual and transgender people. I want to know where the rest of the campaigners in Europe were. Where were you all? How did you miss this? Why weren't you getting your governments to lobby as well? Because these are the things we must be doing. Now, in fact, the UK government did eventually persuade in October last year, the Council of Ministers, to actually agree a unanimous footnote. And that footnote says, not very much, but it says that they note the European Court of Justice decision in PNS, the Cornwall County Council, the employment case. Now, this is a ringing endorsement. This doesn't say, great, we must have trans protection, but it is a clear suggestion to the Court of Justice that in the future, in any cases related to goods and services, they should be interpreted in the same way that the employment cases were interpreted. Right? That is a really, really positive thing. And we're going to have to be looking for those goods and services cases to take. But the thing that is really important here is that it actually embodies the idea that we're not second-class citizens in just accessing the shops, going to get our hair cut. You know, very simple things. I just finished with the last statement. One of the critical problems is that sex equality language is still stuck in language and concepts that are 40 years out of date. If you think about race equality, right, race equality starts not from the individual person, but starts from the idea of diversity of race. So when we're looking at equality issues, we shouldn't be talking about sex or men and women. We should be talking about the diversity of gender in our equality laws related to gender. So we should be campaigning for that, for a rewrite as it raises equality, instead of this essentialist, binary, ancient wording that currently exists. Yeah. We have a chance as people now, effective campaigners, to make a difference. But be aware, no matter what you or I think, there are an awful lot of trans people out there who believe that there are only men and women. Not anything else, nothing in between or nothing outside. So when we're campaigning, we have to educate all those people that are not just men and women. I'm Stephen, you've all got names, that's who we are. And we have a whole diversity of genders between us. Okay, thank you very much.